Metaphysical.
The dark side.
Love haunted houses. I love houses. Anything horror. I love bizarre. All of it. All of it.
Deeper and deeper.
The Church of Mavis.
Oh, I'm stoked. I'm ready for
this. I am the Lord. Rocket.
I'm shaking.
The Church of Mavis.
Oh, I'm stoked. I'm ready for this.
Welcome to the Church of Mavis Radio Show. It's Friday. You're listening to 107.7 New Orleans and 105.3 Henderson Point, Mississippi. Running a little bit late, but we're here. We made it in one piece. Had some tech stuff going on, but we're here. I had to turn off the cam and the Pal Talk because Tartu is sitting there in his underwear again. For some reason, when I go to Pal Talk, it opens up Tartu's cam, and it's open, and it's like Willie Nelson, Cheech and Chong sitting in his underwear every time. And I have to close it real quick because, well, first off, I have terrible internet using it. It's the most horrible internet ever. Never get it. But I have to get it because I'm in the wilderness, and it's a dish in my yard. In Florida, they don't even have real internet in Florida. Not where I'm at. But anyway, for some reason, as soon as you go into Pal Talk, Tartu in his underwear pops up, and I have to look at Tartu in his underwear, so I close it really fast. No offense, Tartu. You're a handsome man, but...
that's a little TMI.
Yeah. I'm heterosexual, so let's keep it at that. But, nonetheless, I just got Doom in the mail. It came out Friday the 13th. It's Friday the 13th. The
yes,
new Doom, I haven't played it yet. It's installing right now. I'll play it after the show, but I'm looking forward to it. Looking forward to the gore and the demons and the slaughtering and the madness. Well, let me see. Make sure I got everything, plugged everything. Got a good little hopping chat room. Let's get to the guests. Tonight's guest is Seth Breedlove. He has a documentary, Beast of Whitehall.
Oh, yes.
Yes, the Bear Road Incident. And we're going to discuss it. I just watched it yesterday. I had it for a few weeks, but I wanted to make sure I would watch it like right before the show so it was fresh on my memory because my memory's terrible. And I really enjoyed it. Watched all of it, all the unedited scenes and all the extra stuff. Watched every little bit of it. I also have his first DVD, Minerva. The Minerva Monster, right, Seth? Minerva,
yeah.
I have it. Yeah, Minerva. Love it. And that's by the production company Small Town Monsters. I've had Seth interviewed him once before on Examiner in written form, and now we're here in audio on Friday the 13th to summon the beast. So good to have you here, Seth, and then my co-host Wham is here. So So great to have you here on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
Well, I guess first off, tell us a little bit about yourself, and then I want you to talk a little bit about your first documentary, just to give people a little bit of background on that, and then we'll get into Beast of Whitehall.
Yeah. I'm a newbie to the filmmaking thing. That's kind of something I just got into about 2 years ago. I kind of started out as a newspaper reporter, and the secret origin story for Small Town Monsters is that it was originally a book project that I was putting together for a book I'd wanted to write on. I've always been fascinated by these like kind of small town monster cases, and part of that has to do with the fact that I grew up in a small town in northeastern Ohio that had its own monster. So, but I was aware of the Minerva monster, and Minerva was only about 20 minutes away from where I grew up. So I started to think that maybe every town has its own kind of monster. I mean, obviously every town has its own legends, but I was thinking that, you know, like there seems to be an ongoing thing from town to town. And I was fascinated by kind of how these cases affect the town and the communities where they take place. So I had looked into a bunch of different sightings that kind of piqued my interest, and one of them was Minerva, and the other was Whitehall, and then there was a couple other ones. Falk was not in my original proposal because Lyle Blackburn had already covered that in his Beast of Boggy Creek book. But nonetheless, I put together this proposal. I sent it around to a bunch of different kind of paranormal topic publishers and was kind of unanimously rejected is how I always put it. They were all publishing Bigfoot stuff at the time and felt like my book just didn't, you know, fit in with their kind of printing schedule. So I decided about 6 months later, I just decided we were going to do this as a series of films. And that's kind of where I started. But obviously, like my background in newspaper reporting helped because we were able to do, you know, we already had the research kind of in place for the first story of Minerva Monster. And it was just one thing led to the next, and we just kind of, you know, wrapped up our third filming for Boggy Creek Monster, which is our follow-up to Beast of Whitehall. So it's this whole series of kind of small-town monsters movies, and And the other thing, I get asked this a lot, so I'll just go ahead and answer it now, but there is, you know, we have an eye for other monsters beyond just Bigfoot. It just so happens that the first few stories that instantly had kind of grabbed my attention were all Bigfoot stories, but we always talk about Mothman. Like, Mothman seems to be the granddaddy of kind of what I term the like classic small town monster case, where the town is deeply affected by it to the point where they have, you know, the festival and the museum and all that kind of stuff. There's a statue, and that's kind of what I'm really intrigued by, is culturally when a town kind of embraces their local monster. So,
one thing that fascinates me are these towns that embrace these monsters, and then it gets kind of, you know, out of hand, like Bigfoot burgers and, you know, buy a tire, get one free, the Bigfoot special, and it gets really weird, like, you know, Willow Creek, all that stuff, the like Bobcat Goldthwait movie and stuff like that. But one thing, I mean, I love your documentaries, and I hope you keep doing them, and I'm always going to keep supporting them, because there's not enough of these kind of documentaries out there, and a lot of the ones out there, let's face it, they're not all that great. There's some really good ones, but there's some that are just like, ugh. I really like yours, and I hope you keep putting them out. And one thing I really enjoyed in Beast of Whitehall was in the extras, when it really started getting weird, like with, what's his name, Paul Bartholomew? Bartholomew? And, you know, got into Thunderbirds and UFOs, and I'm like, I'd like to really see you go off the deep end with maybe Mothman or something like that and get more into that kind of weird. We have Andrew Colvin coming on. I wrote a book with him. He's a Mothman photographer, and he writes books about Mothman, and he has a publishing, New Saucerian Press, and they've been putting out a lot of John Keel stuff with the permission of the family reprints and stuff. And we did a book on Bigfoot called Praise for the Hairy Man, The Secret Life of Bigfoot, and just had one come out, Probes Happen, The Secret Life of Aliens, and it's interviews with all these different people in written form. But if you do the Mothman one, let me know, and I'll hook you up with Andy if you're interested in that. But definitely love your documentaries and hope you keep doing them. I'm looking forward to the Bogey Creek and definitely some... The Lizard Man, that'd be a good one, too.
I just mentioned...
Lyle did that book, didn't he? I've had Lyle on before. What was the... He did a Lizard Man book, too.
Yeah, he did the Lizard Man of Bishopville, South Carolina, and I just mentioned that somewhere today, recently, and now there's a rumor going around that's our next Small Town Monster movie, but I don't think that's the case. But remind me, when we get to Beast of Whitehall, to talk... You mentioned Thunderbirds. I have a cool story about Thunderbirds in the Whitehall area.
Go ahead and spill it. I usually go all over the place. So
that's cool. That's the way I like to be. When we were there in Whitehall, there aren't many people in the movie. So when I say this, it's going to be pretty obvious who I'm talking about. But one of our key witnesses in the movie, who was a law officer, in Whitehall, he actually told us that two other law officers that he worked with. Were out on patrol and saw what they said was a pterodactyl come out of the sky and land in the forest. And this story was repeated by another person in the movie as being something that they were also told. So this wasn't just Brian. Oh, geez, I just gave it away. This wasn't just Brian giving us a story. It was backed up by other people. So apparently... There's a lot of kind of unusual activity that takes place in Whitehall. There were multiple officers that claimed to see this Thunderbird-type creature flying around. And then you've also got Champ. I mean, Lake Champlain butts right up to Whitehall. Whitehall, the Champlain Canal actually runs through the middle of the town, the village of Whitehall. So... And you know, if you watch the extras, you probably heard Paul talking a little bit about the UFO flap, that was for the most part left out of the movie. Not for any particular like agenda, but mostly it just didn't fit in with the story we were telling. You know, our story was very much about Hebert and kind of how culturally the area has been impacted by Bigfoot. And I just felt like if we start bringing any UFOs, it opens up the whole other rabbit trail that I had no way of going down. But there was actually a UFO flap that took place that same week as the Hebert incident. And in fact, there was a police report made that was covered by Wilford Gosselin, who obviously was extremely tied to the Hebert incident as well. A lady called and told him that there was a UFO that had landed, like a flying saucer is what she said, that landed in her front yard. And the craziest thing about it is that her front yard is right downtown Whitehall, like right in the middle of downtown. So the police showed up, Wilford Gosselin showed up to investigate the call, and they found a huge circular patch of what looked like burned grass in her front yard, right downtown Whitehall. And this was in the same week that all the other craziness was going on and that obviously the creature sightings were taking place out on Hebert Road. So whatever goes on in that area, there's a lot of unusual activity. I think, I can't remember the exact name. I think it's the Bennington Triangle, if I'm not mistaken. But Paul has a lot of information on that region in general, but there is some sort of triangular geographic shape that has a series of weird events that take place right in the center of it, and Whitehall just happens to be a part of that.
Definitely, and the water monsters and stuff, for some reason when you said that, I thought of Skinwalker Ranch and how the natives say that land is cursed, and they talk about the water creatures, seeing weird water stuff there, and then, of course, Bigfoot and UFO activity and, you know, all kinds of weird stuff. So as far as Whitehall, what's the history? I mean, there's a lot of Native history there, too, right? There's a lot of Native American
history. Yeah, there is. Yeah. That was an area, remember that presentation I did, that was an area where the Haudenosaunee people said had been a place where the stone giants lived. and the stone giants were supposed to be a race of beings that preceded human habitation and really didn't care for humans very much. And would when humans first started settling, you know, native humans that either be, you know, the natives started settling in the area, they had to fight the stone giants off because the stone giants would hunt humans and kill them and eat them.
Yeah, nice. There's legends like that. The other one that I always repeat that I think is so fascinating, and I've never heard this in other native kind of legends, but supposedly in that region, Paul told me that there is a history with the natives talking about, and this might not have even been, this might have actually been like settlers in that area, but I always say it's natives. I'm pretty sure it's natives, but it could have been settlers too. It's one or the other. They repeated seeing creatures whose eyes glowed like coals of fire or mm-hmm. timber, something like that, in, right. in that area, which is really, if you are familiar with the Hebert incident and the Whitehall case, I mean, every single person, it seems like, in 1976, in that particular week that the Hebert incident occurred during, those people all repeated seeing a creature with eyes, you know, that glowed red. I mean, and even the year prior when Cliff Sparks saw the creature on the golf course and said it had laser beams coming out of its eyes. I mean, they're all talking about a glowing red-eyed creature.
Yeah. And those were creatures that, see, I live in the Hudson Valley, just mm-hmm. down a little ways from there. Oh. So you do have the Bennington Triangle, which is up north, and actually mm-hmm. Whitehall is in one part of it.
Okay.
Most of it is actually in Vermont,
yeah,
and Massachusetts.
Right.
But it's considered to be connected to a much larger area of which the Adirondacks and the Hudson Valley are a part.
Mm-hmm.
So because if you go up and down the Hudson Valley, for example, there are all kinds of towns. It's almost like every old town and hamlet has their own story. Like there's
right.
the Kinderhook creature, and
yep.
But the natives, all the natives, both the Haudenosaunee, we call them the Iroquois, and the Algonquin peoples who lived up in this area, they all had stories of various types of creatures that they had, they either avoided or they had relationship with in one type or another. And the ones that had the glowing eyes, you avoided
mm-hmm.
because
yeah.
they were considered to be dangerous.
See, the Stonish Giants were one of the first things I heard about when I was first getting into Bigfoot. I'm into history, so I thought, you know, if anyone would have had some sort of contact with creatures like this, you would imagine it would be the Native Americans. So I had looked into kind of on the East Coast what that was like, if there was any kind of history of that, and personally, and I'm a little more on the skeptical side. So personally, I found like the Stonish Giants to bear very little resemblance to what I think of as a Bigfoot type creature.
Oh right, they don't really look like much like one.
Yeah, and it didn't even. I mean, yeah, and the descriptions just didn't line up for me. Whereas on the West Coast, you do have descriptions of creatures that sound a lot like, and in even like the, you know, the hairy man pictographs and all that. It reminds you of what we think of as a Bigfoot. But on
right.
I do find it odd and a case almost against the Bigfoot on the East Coast. Anyway,
well, there is a creature that the Lenape people had relationship with, whose name was Masingwe, and he did resemble more closely what we think of as the classic Bigfoot, but he did not make his appearance known very often. With the Lenape people, they actually had a ritual that they a very long ritual that they had a 12-day ritual every fall. Specifically to Masingwe, and that was the only time that they formally attempted to contact him.
The ritual didn't involve a circle, like a prayer circle, sitting in
well,
a circle.
It had a lodge. They would build a lodge,
okay.
and all of the people in the vicinity would. It was called the Great House or the Sinquicon. And they would gather together, and I suppose there were circles in there, but it was mostly a gathering of the entire community. Mm-hmm. And they would formally, it was a time when everybody would share what visions and dreams they had, but the most important thing was that they were renewing their relationship with Missingwe, who was understood to be the guardian of the forest.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Iroquois had a separate ritual that they did where they commemorated apparently a similar being, but they had a different name for him, which I can't pronounce. And he was considered to be not only a guardian of the forest, but he also maintained certain kinds of healing knowledge, you know, medicine. And not everybody contacted him, but in both instances, he was portrayed as, you rarely saw his face, but the way he was portrayed in ritual or ceremony was through a mask that was half black and half red.
Okay.
And versions of this mask would be used to decorate the lodges. And in fact, the Haudenosaunee still do their version of whatever this is today. The Lenape don't anymore because most of them dispersed and no longer live here. So the Great House ceremony sort of fell into disuse. But the last Great House ceremony was performed in 1927 in Oklahoma,
okay.
Because that was the last place that a lot of the they were called Delaware. They came to be called the Delaware. That was the last place where a lot of them ended up in the United States. The most of them actually, there are three main places where the Delaware are. One is in Canada, one is in Wisconsin, and one is in Oklahoma.
Okay.
But Missingwe did resemble what we think of as a Bigfoot.
That's fantastic. See, I didn't know that.
Yeah, a lot of people don't actually. But
when I was in Whitehall about 3 weeks ago, we did the premiere of the. Well, I guess actually now it's over a month. Good grief. When I was there, there was a Native American man that came up to me and told me his sighting story, and it was basically that he went on some sort of, you know, whatever they do, I don't know. He was trying to tell me, it was right before a screening, so I was doing like six things at once, but he told me that he had gone out and prayed, mm-hmm. and during his prayers, he looked up and there was a white, what he described as a Bigfoot, female Bigfoot. Mm-hmm. looking at him through the woods, and there was lightning striking the ground around him, and I mean, it was intense, whatever he was, you know, trying to relay, but unfortunately I was so busy at the time, I didn't get any more information, and he was gone as soon as the screening was
done. It would be interesting to know what people he was from, because actually the lightning hitting the ground, at least for the Haudenosaunee, would be highly significant, because that would be related to one of their guardian spirits. That would be interesting to know which people he was from,
mm-hmm.
but because that's actually rather significant, because that particular spirit, that lightning spirit for the Haudenosaunee, he actually protects. One of the things he does is he protects the Haudenosaunee who are doing spiritual things. He protects them from harm.
Okay.
So that's fascinating.
Yeah, I thought so too. But I can't remember where I was. I was supposed to talk about Minerva. Did you want me to relay a little bit about Minerva?
Oh yeah, talk about Minerva.
Jump back over. Minerva was like I said, it was a case that I grew up with because it took place so close to my house, and even as a kid, I can remember hearing about the Minerva monster. I just wasn't really aware of what it was. And then when I really got into Bigfoot, that was kind of one of the first cases I investigated. And I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to go back and kind of track down some of these original witnesses, some of the people that worked the case, and then interview them for the book. And I actually went so far as to, you know, I had phone numbers. I had talked to a couple of different people. I even interviewed Barbara Galloway, who wrote the articles on the Minerva Monster sightings for the Akron Beacon Journal. And then when the movie kind of started to happen, I was able to just put all those interviews in place, you know, to kind of go out and investigate that sighting. But that sighting is really unique because it's it's Northeast Ohio, obviously. Everyone always connects Northeast Ohio with Salt Fork State Park, which is supposedly like the Bigfoot mecca of Ohio, which I'm a little skeptical about. But it was it's actually a really unique case because this one particular family outside of Minerva during one summer in 1978 reportedly had this one creature throwing rocks at their house and just all kinds of, you know, kind of typical Bigfoot, classic kind of Bigfoot behavior behind the house. And almost every member of the family had some sort of, you know, encounter or sighting of the creature. And that was kind of the classic story. That was what I knew about the case, was that this family saw a Bigfoot behind their house. And really, other than the newspapers reporting that, you know, the family looked at it almost as a pet, there wasn't a lot of information on it. So what I found out when we started investigating the Minerva monster for the movie was that, you know, in 1978, yes, this family did have encounters with the creature that ended up spurring them to call the police, which they'd never done before. The main kind of event that happened that caused them to call the police, or fear, I guess, for their safety, was that they found their dog one night, or one morning, they found their dog actually ripped out of its collar with its neck snapped. And their other dog had dug about a 6-foot deep tunnel wide enough for two dogs under its house to hide in. So whatever had terrified it enough to dig itself under this house. So they had called the police, and because of that, of course, the story hit the news wire and the media circus kind of began. And, you know, before they knew it, there were hunters crawling all over their woods looking for a Bigfoot to kill, and their entire summer basically became a giant circus. But what we found out was that there was this history with the Caton family that went back years before 1978. There were other incidents. In fact, there was one in particular where the youngest son, Howie, and some of his friends were walking around a pond, and they saw this creature kind of down off of a ravine, and they decided they were going to jump it. So they actually, according to Howie, jumped this creature. Four of these kids, one of the kids got thrown to the ground, and his brother was bit by this thing, which I thought was just fascinating because I've never heard anything like that in a Bigfoot sighting. But there were all these kind of, you know, things happening with the Caton family over this one summer, but what we came to find out during the making of the movie is that it's still going on today. In fact, like during last summer, after the movie had come out, some of our team went out, some of the crew went down there just to hang out with the Caton family. And they hiked about 3 miles back into the woods, and in the middle of nowhere, they found a track, like clear as day, pretty good sized track back in the woods. The family has pictures and all kind of stuff, but that was the case that kind of cemented for me what Small Town Monsters is about, which is, you know, these unusual creature sightings and how they affect the local culture of the community. What we found in Minerva that was kind of cool is that the town had obviously remembered, but they'd completely forgotten about this case. I mean, when we were making the movie, we couldn't find people that could talk about it because no one could remember the Minerva Monster case. Some of the older people did, but, you know, younger people and kids especially had no clue what we were talking about. So there was a lot of stuff for us to investigate with that movie and kind of bring forward. We were able to turn up some new sightings, too. That the craziest would be, in 1978, what the Caton family was seeing was a hair-covered, upright-walking creature that was always flanked or accompanied by two panthers. Basically, two black panthers.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, and I'd never heard anything like that, although I've since come to find out that Lauren Coleman actually told me there's a bunch of sightings from the 70s with that same thing. Upright walking creature and accompanied by felines. So that's what the family claimed to be seeing. And then I found a witness named Scott Finnegan. He actually gave me a call. We had already wrapped filming on the movie, and he gave me a call and said, "Hey, you know, I saw your name in the newspaper, and I saw you're making a movie on the Minerva Monster." And he's like, "I saw something in Minerva when I was 8 years old, in that same summer. So it was the same summer of 1978. He had a sighting right across the, it'd be maybe a half mile from the Caton home. He was back in the woods with a friend of his, and they saw an upright walking creature with two small ones with it. His, that's how he referred to them, was small ones. Juveniles is basically what he was saying. So I thought that was really curious because the Caton family is repeatedly seeing this creature with felines, and this guy's telling us he saw, you know, a Bigfoot, basically. I mean, what he, how he actually referred to it was a hairy witch, which I thought was kind of cool because that's, as a kid, that's what he connected with. You know, like he didn't understand what he was seeing, and he did understand hairy witch, but, you know, when he describes it to you, he's describing a Bigfoot, kind of a classic. Actually, not a classic Bigfoot, but he's describing exactly what the Caton family was describing, which is almost a Momo type. I don't know if you guys are familiar with the Momo case.
Yeah,
it's almost that type of Bigfoot as opposed to your classic kind of Patterson-Gimlin, you know, hair-covered ape-like creature. These things are just covered in hair, almost like Cousin It or something. So that's... that's kind of what the Catons were describing. That's what this guy described to us. And then he described seeing it with two juveniles. So, you know, we theorized that maybe what the Catons were seeing was juveniles kind of hunched forward or maybe, I mean, the thing of it is, I say that we theorize that, but the Catons have also shown me photographs of mountain lions behind their house. So I know for a fact there are mountain lions down there. In fact, I made a, we do, my company does videography as well, and we did a commercial for an alpaca farm about 2 miles from the Caton's house. It would actually even share the same wood line as the Caton's house. And, the lady there told me that she hears feline screams and cries all the time where she is. So there's, I do know that there are mountain lions down in that area, but trying to make sense of some sort of, you know, biological, natural creature walking around accompanied by two, you know, black panthers, which makes it even more unusual, doesn't make a ton of sense. So there's something, there's really a lot of odd things that happened with the Minerva case, just like with Whitehall, because it was, you know, there's also one of the weirder aspects of the case. We asked, and I don't think this is in the movie, but we asked the sheriff, James Shannon, if he had seen, you know, anything else unusual in his career, because this guy was prolific in his law enforcement career. He was the sheriff of Canton, Ohio, which is, you know, pretty big city and a lot of crime and all that stuff. So he's got some amazing stories. He told us the only other unusual incident report he ever investigated was a UFO sighting. He said this family called one day and reported seeing a UFO land in the field right behind their house, and that they lived directly across the street from the Catons. So, and it was within 2 weeks of the 1978 Minerva Monster sightings. So those were the only two unusual incidents he'd ever investigated, and they happened within 2 weeks of each other right across the street from one another. So there was a lot of weird activity taking place in Minerva at that time. Obviously, part of that is going to be chalked up to, you know, guys with guns, drunk, running around the woods trying to shoot a Bigfoot, and people playing pranks on other people because that was going on at the time. In fact, I talked to a man recently who claims to know the Minerva Monster. That was what that was how he put it to me. He said, "I actually know the Minerva Monster." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, there used to be a guy that played football in a neighboring town, and he was 7'2". He would put on a gorilla costume and go down by the Lincoln Highway, right coming into Minerva, which is the Lincoln Highway. The Catons live off the Lincoln Highway. And he would jump out and scare passing cars, you know, which that could explain some of the road crossing sightings there are, because there are definitely road crossing sightings in that area. But what it doesn't explain is why some idiot would put on a gorilla costume and go running into a woods full of drunken Bigfoot hunters. Because there were sightings taking place around the same time.
Well, and then there's still the mountain lions or big felines or whatever that is.
Sure.
You know? But let me ask you, because I was looking up where Minerva is. Mm-hmm. Is Is it in a part of Ohio that has a lot of Indian mounds or anything around it?
So with the Indian mounds, I think typically people associate those with more Southwest Ohio, which is down
Columbus
and Hocking Hills.
By Newark and...
Right. All that kind of area.
Okay.
And those,
okay, so you're up further north than
we're
that.
Further northeast, but that doesn't mean they're not down there. And certainly there's a lot of Native history in that area. I grew up in Bolivar, and Bolivar's home to Fort Lawrence, which is kind of home of one of these famous battles that took place during the French and Indian War, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. And actually, funny you bring that up. The region... So what got me into Bigfoot is actually Bolivar, where I grew up. There were some weird incidents that happened down there back in the 70s, and they took place on a road called St. Peter's Church Road. And off this road is an old cemetery with graves going back to the 1700s. And in that area, there supposedly was a lot of Native, either road or however you term that, they traveled through that area constantly.
Right. Yeah, there were roads actually through those, Native roads.
Environment.
Ohio was a, Ohio,
and protecting
especially
the
in the
there's
eastern,
been a lot of progress.
The southeastern
aside,
part of the
work
state,
together,
and there's a lot
probably,
more we can do.
Is a center for the Adena and Hopewell cultures, or was, and so there were all kinds of roads and thoroughfares. There.
Yeah, I mean, I'm more on the skeptical side, but I find this stuff so fascinating. The Caton family has told us that they've seen a woman in white riding around on a horse behind their house. They said they've heard like Native chanting, all kinds of stuff. And I will say that the woods behind their house are dense, and they can go for miles. I said we took a plane to actually get some of the aerial footage that's in the movie, and when you're up there and you look behind their house, you could walk all the way to Pennsylvania and rarely leave the woods other than maybe to cross a road here and there. So you could walk for 100 miles and stay in the woods.
It's pretty dense. Is it pretty uninhabited?
It's the way that area, that section of Ohio is there's just really dense, patchy woods. I'm not going to say that it's some sort of uninhabited Pacific Northwest like wilderness, because it's not. But you could stay in relative cover pretty easily in northeast Ohio, especially because the further toward Pennsylvania you get, the less inhabited it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Are you there, Jeffrey?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm a rowdy chat room tonight. I'm here. I'm listening.
Okay.
One thing that interested me a lot about the different cases and the Beast of Whitehall is how the witnesses experience how it goes down, so to speak. The witnesses see it, and then the town finds out, and then of course people make fun of the witnesses, and then of course you had some people. The story of the policeman who was shaken and, didn't want to talk about it, and the different levels of how it affects the town and the community, and I find that very fascinating.
Yeah, I do too, and it seems like they all kind of follow the same pattern. Like you said, that someone sees something, the town gets wind of it, and there's typically just an automatic response of ridicule toward whoever reports the sighting. In the case of Minerva, it was the Caton family. Howie Caton told me that the last year of high school was one of the most miserable years of his life because of how much kind of ribbing he took. Kids would drive up their driveway screaming Bigfoot, throw things at the house, all kinds of stuff. With the Whitehall case, obviously the family, there is a family at the heart of the Whitehall movie, and that's the Gosselin family. But obviously the law officers and the three boys that claimed to see the creature out on Avery, they all took a lot of ridicule. And then it seems like things kind of died down and decades pass, and then the town comes around to almost embrace that history. And I think that's an important part of the process, frankly. And I always say, whether or not you're a Bigfoot believer, you have to understand that these cases play a huge part in your local history and informing what the community is, and it's a piece of the puzzle that is the town's history. And if someone doesn't document these cases, they're going to be lost to time. And, you know, someday generations will have no idea these things ever happened. And it's sad because I just think there are, I think whether or not anything, you know, beyond hysteria or something like that was behind it, whether or not there is a creature out there, these are still very vital pieces of that history. And the people that saw this stuff were affected greatly by what happened. So for me, I've always been, I grew up in a very, my family loved history. My mom and dad owned a bookstore, historical bookstore. So I don't know if that plays a role in doing this type of stuff. But for me, if someone doesn't kind of document, and not that there aren't other people documenting this, obviously, because like Lauren Coleman's done amazing work and Lyle Blackburn's done his Boggy Creek work, and there are countless other people that are writing books about, you know, these scenarios. But my approach is very much on the impact on the community. And I think where that'll come through probably even more so than with Whitehall is going to be with the Boggy Creek movie that we just finished filming, because it's FALC is kind of Bigfoot HQ outside of the Pacific Northwest. You know, they have the big store with the giant Bigfoot on the roof and all that stuff. So I'm deeply fascinated by culturally what happens in a small town after a sighting that ends up gaining some sort of prominence.
Definitely. It's definitely fascinating to follow in the way that, you know, I'm someone that's had a lot of paranormal experiences in the past from when I was younger, and I've dealt with how people react to it. It's like, and with Bigfoot, well, just briefly, when I was 17, I had testicular cancer, and I was healed from that, and several years later, my dad died, and I started to have UFO sightings, and I saw a lot of different types of beings. I've seen beings of light. I've seen beings that were very, I call the serpentines. They're almost like holograms, very reptilian-like. Mm-hmm. And I believe when I went through, you know, a shamanic death of sorts, that it opened up my senses. So I've always been very open about these subjects, and, you know, it scares a lot of people away who aren't used to it at all, or they don't even go there on any level whatsoever. Like, there are people online, like a personal site or something, I'll say I'm a paranormal radio show host. Some of the women here will be like, they run, you're like the devil to them. Like, the Lord's going to get you, and they're gone.
Yeah.
But so I've dealt with all the different levels of that. And it's definitely fascinating, though, the way these towns do. And I know we saw some of the culture in that, you know, Bobcat Goldthwait, Willow Creek movie. And that was one of my favorite parts of that movie, was just the singing and the, you know, the culture and all that. And there are some other documentaries out there, Southern Fried Bigfoot and some others that get into that. What's the other one? God, Letters to the Big Man. That one was pretty interesting. Did you ever see that one?
I haven't seen that one yet, but I have seen Southern Fried Bigfoot. I think is fantastic. In fact, I mean, in my opinion, there's really modern Bigfoot documentaries, especially independent ones. There aren't many that are very good. That's one of the few that I can point to and say that's a really great independent Bigfoot documentary. I mean, that's kind of the bar that I'm trying to reach is what Sean Whitley did with that movie.
Letters from the Big Man, you should check it out. It's pretty, it's different. It's like a movie, but I've interviewed Christopher Munch, and it's got Lily Rabe in it, that chick from American Horror Story, The Blonde, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, yeah.
And there's some weird metaphysical Bigfoot stuff going on and some weird government secret black agent stuff. It's pretty weird. It's good. It's different. It was definitely different for sure.
Yeah, I liked. I haven't seen it yet. I need to see that. But you mentioned Willow Creek, and that one is. See, for me, Willow Creek is a great movie until it becomes a horror movie. I love the kind of the part of it where it's just exploring the culture around Willow Creek and the Bigfoot. It's almost like a Bigfoot documentary or mockumentary of the community, and then it becomes a horror movie. And what I would love to see Bobcat Goldthwait do something that's focused entirely on the community, or, you know, almost like a Small Town Monsters type movie.
Definitely. In the end of it, I was kind of disappointed with the way that ended and everything.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, and there wasn't enough emphasis on the end. It was like a minute or so. I mean, it wasn't even, I don't know what it was, like, so fast. I had to go back and, like, watch it, see what the hell even happened.
Right.
But I like Bobcat Goldthwait a lot in his filmmaking. One of my favorite movies, I don't know if you've seen, is God Bless America. Did you see that one?
I haven't seen it yet, but I respect that guy as a filmmaker immensely, because I think he's super talented, and I like his... I just like his kind of outlook on stuff. The way he talks is fascinating to me. And he's a pretty, like, ardent atheist, whereas I'm a pretty ardent Christian. But the stuff the guy talks about when it comes to Christianity versus atheism, he just has a eloquence to the way he talks about things that I've really respected for a long time. And when I found out he was into the subject of Bigfoot, that was kind of cool to me, because he's a legit filmmaker. Like, say what you will about his movies, but he's got his own style, and he's extremely talented. So someone like that bringing anything to the Bigfoot world should be embraced, even if you don't automatically love the movie.
Yeah, God Bless America is really dark and disturbing, but funny at the same time. It's about
right.
a guy that goes crazy, and he becomes a spree killer, and, like, starts killing right-wing personalities, and
mm-hmm.
it's really good. I love it, but
yeah.
Definitely, it's pretty intense, though. No doubt about it.
Yeah,
you'll be transformed. But yeah, you got to check that one out. I'd watch it again easily.
Yeah.
I've seen it a few times, but. Yeah, as far as what about paranormal experiences? Have you had any personal paranormal experiences? Have you had anything happen?
Nothing paranormal, Bigfoot related. We've had, you know, you would think you're in these places where all this amazing stuff has happened. You'd think we'd have more to tell as far as, like, our own personal kind of things, but we've only had two kind of really intriguing things happen. When we were making Beast of Whitehall, we were out at Abair Road one night, kind of late in the evening. I think it was around midnight. And, you know, I was actually, what's crazy is I was in the spot where Brian would have been when he saw the creature. And I was looking at my producer, and behind my producer is a house now. They actually built a house back further back in the field off of Abair Road. And there was a light on the house, and you could, you know, behind my producer, you could see this light, and something ran full tilt right behind him, maybe 100 yards behind him, and blocked out the light for a second. That's why I saw it. You know, you could see this very clear silhouette. And to my eyes, what I saw looked like an upright, walking, running individual. But it could have, you know, it was so quick and so vague, it could have been anything. Could have been a deer, for all I know. But it was kind of cool, because we're in this spot where all this amazing stuff happened, you know, back in 1976, all these law officers and everything, and all of a sudden I had my own fleeting glimpse of something kind of running across that field. So that was one kind of unusual thing. And then the other is that when we were making Boggy Creek Monster, we actually did catch what sounds very much like the famous Ohio Howl. And it was actually during the setup for an interview. We were setting up, and we were in a sighting location, and the witness was with us. And as we're setting up, we had just turned the mics on. We were running some sound tests, and all of a sudden you hear what is very clearly not a coyote or an owl, but you can hear it actually echo. And it was full tilt, and our witness and Lyle Blackburn both instantly kind of said that.
Whoa.
Yeah, they were both kind of like, that was not a person or an owl or a coyote, that was something unusual. So, and we caught that on audio, so we actually have it, and we're able to boost it. I haven't decided yet if it'll be in the movie. It would definitely be on the DVD in some capacity if it's not in the movie, but we might be able to even include it in the movie, because it's I don't know if you guys are familiar with the Ohio Howl, but that's what it sounds like.
Yeah, I know what it is.
When are you expecting this one to come out, the next one?
Boggy, I'm editing right now. We got back, well, it's been 2 weeks now, and I am in the process of getting the interviews ready to kind of fully start editing the movie. So my dream is to have it done by Halloween, obviously, because that would be awesome. This one is a little different from the other two. I'm not 100% sure it's going to go straight to DVD. It could end up, you know, in other places. I've really enjoyed kind of doing our theatrical screenings with the other movies we've released. And so far, we've pretty much stuck to Ohio with these theatrical screenings. But we did do a screening in New York. So I'm considering maybe with Boggy trying to take a different approach. We might even pursue theatrical distribution, like wide theatrical distribution with it. It's far beyond anything we've done. It's far beyond Whitehall, and it's far beyond Minerva. And the story is so fascinating, and it's tied into the original, you know, Legend of Boggy Creek film. So I can say the first place people will be able to kind of see it, in not the full movie, but at least some footage, a sneak preview of the movie. We do a festival now in Minerva called Minerva Monster Day, which I hype up as being the world's only cryptozoology film festival and conference. So this year, Lauren Coleman speaking, and we'll show Whitehall, Beast of Whitehall, we'll show Minerva Monster, and then we're having another movie called I've Seen Bigfoot, and then we have a documentary on Loch Ness Monster we're going to show this year. But
and when is that?
That is September 23rd and 24th. The main kind of event takes place on the 24th. On the 23rd is an amateur short film monster movie film festival.
So the reason I'm asking is that me or someone else might be able to make it.
Yeah, no, definitely. Anyone should come.
So do you have a, is like there a website for it?
Yeah,
or?
It's MinervaMonsterDay.com, and you should be able to get all your info on there. If you have questions, if someone's listening and they have questions about it, just email me at Seth@MinervaMonsterDay.com, and I'll answer questions. But we're just kind of starting to get, you know, the promotion going on it. But this year is going to be, last year we had about 1,400 people come out, so it was a decent sized event for a tiny little, you know, small town monster festival.
Oh right,
festival.
Exactly. That's really really good for us it was a
thrill. And this year we're kind of combining it with the Oktoberfest. So if you're up for, and then there's a huge hot rod car show going on somewhere nearby too. So it's kind of, if someone wants to make a weekend out of it, you could. But we're definitely going to screen some sort of sneak preview of the movie, and that will include a Q&A with me and then my producer and then my whole crew. I'm going to get all the guys that went together down to Falk. We're still recuperating from that trip because it was 6 14-hour days back-to-back with no days really to break. There was one day where we got a little nap in the afternoon for about two hours, but it was 6 back-to-back days, 6 14-hour days. So we're still kind of recuperating, just starting to get into the swing of like editing the movie and getting everything in place. But the movie, I can tell you this, and I don't think this is hyperbole, but to me, if nothing else, the footage I've seen that my guy shot down there is some of the best Bigfoot documentary footage I've ever seen. I mean, we were able to get, you know, we took gimbals out on the swamps and the rivers, and we took a gimbal with an A7S, which is this amazing low-light camera. We took it down on Mercer Bayou, and you get to see all these kind of places you've probably only heard about before or maybe seen in quick snippets here and there on, like, Monster Quest. And we were down there shooting for hours and hours and days. So some of the footage we got is unbelievable. Drone footage. We were the first film crew to be allowed to shoot on the Crabtree property, which is featured in Legend of Boggy Creek. We're the first people to shoot there since the original Legend of Boggy Creek.
Nice.
So there's a lot of stuff in this.
And that movie scared the crap out of me when I was a kid. Oh my God. That was like my introduction, you know, to Bigfoot stuff. So
it was for a ton of people.
Great. Yeah.
I know. I'm surprised how many people say that movie got them into Bigfoot. I've seen it, and I've seen it like in modern times. I didn't see it back when it came out, and I've watched it like in modern times, and I'm like, this is it. I mean, I don't hate it or anything, but a lot of times I'm like,
well, right. Well, you know, it's an old style movie. I mean, you know, it's like in the style of what, the middle 70s or something. You know, I mean, when I saw it, nothing like it had really been done.
Well,
quite
I
like
mean,
it, you know,
it's,
and so.
It's considered, it's almost considered the grandfather to the found footage genre, you know, like
exactly.
Like Eduardo Sanchez, who made Blair Witch Project, always cites Legend of Boggy Creek as an inspiration for him. And I'm kind of like you, Jeff, because like I saw it 3 years ago. That was the first time I saw it, and my first reaction to it was okay.
You guys are young. I mean, it's like I'm probably 20, 30 years older than both of you, and so
Really grown to love it though since then, and I've seen it multiple times. But the thing that draws me back and the thing that I draw inspiration from is Charles B. Pierce's determination to make the freaking movie, because he you know, he's this completely independent filmmaker. He's down there learning how to use the camera while he's making the movie, and he's out, you know, getting things done on his own. It's just it was kind of surreal to be making the movie, because it was like we were following in his footsteps. We were going to all these locations. We were the first film crew to go back to the Searcy house, which in the movie there's the Searcy house scene, which is kind of one of the famous kind of points in the movie. And we were able to go back there and film. And the footage we got there is kind of heartbreaking, because the house is kind of ramshackle now. There's an entire back wall that's kind of caved away from the house, and able to film that stuff. And it was a crazy experience being there, but I really cannot wait to get this movie done. This is like the first time I'm just unbelievably anxious to get the movie done so people can see it.
Well, it's almost sort of like a, it sounds like it's almost sort of like a homage sort of movie too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the sense that you know, this for many people, especially of my generation, this was, Boggy Creek was really, I mean, part of the reason why I didn't get into Bigfoot until later in life, to be honest, is because that movie scared me so much. As a kid, it scared me so much. I mean, I was less afraid of aliens and UFOs and being abducted than I was of being scared off the toilet from a monster peeking in my window. There was something that was very earthy about that film, you know, and sort of brought home the experience.
Yeah, it's not, it is unusual too, because it's a G-rated horror film. So we watch it now, and there's these hokey kind of, well, what we think is hokey, singing, you know, like musical interludes.
Oh, I know.
Yeah. But at the same time, those freaking songs, I got to tell you, when we were down there, that Travis Crabtree song, we were literally walking around filming singing that song, because it gets stuck in your head. You're in that place, and those songs are so tied to that movie and that place. But the movie is, I still think Legend of Boggy Creek is a gorgeously, beautifully shot film. And some people would probably argue with me, because there are some bad edits and there's some weird things going on. But I think Charles Pierce's framing on some of the shots, and then the way he was shooting this thing, always in the low light. There's always, it always seems like the sun is just setting somewhere off screen, and then you get those dark, the nighttime kind of scenes. You never even really get a glimpse of the creature, which is something that I have to wonder if Steven Spielberg didn't draw inspiration from that when he was working on Jaws. I mean, you have to wonder if he didn't look at that and say, hey, you know what, that worked for them. We should maybe, since our shark is completely folded and fallen apart, maybe we should do the same thing.
It's also a classic horror thing.
Right.
Are any of you familiar with that alien found footage flick that was like the McPherson tape?
Exactly,
yeah.
To bring that up is insane, because my producer and I want to make a documentary on the McPherson tapes, because it wasn't just like, we want to make a movie on the McPherson tapes and then also the blowback from the McPherson tapes, like the way some of the more like, you know, the conspiracy theorists and stuff got involved and decided it was like an actual film. There's some really interesting stories behind that movie.
That would be a good one for sure. It popped into my head, and I have it on a disc somewhere, but I couldn't remember the name of it, so I put it in Google, and I found the name of it, and I went to find another copy if I can't find my copy and watch that one. That was really weird because I heard people talking about it like it was real, and then I watched it and realized it wasn't, but it's still weird. It's really weird.
Yeah.
It's like 1989.
Right.
Well,
Go ahead.
I'm
sorry, is that the first found footage? Or was Boggy Creek before that? 1989.
Boggy Creek was like in the was much earlier.
Boggy Creek is 1971, but Boggy Creek isn't purporting to be found footage. It's more like a pseudo documentary. It almost purports itself as a documentary in a way, but
it's like a docudrama kind of.
Right, and that's what they call it, as a docudrama. But the style really reminds you of a found footage movie, and I think it at least inspired in some way people to kind of create that found footage genre.
Definitely. Didn't they do a sequel to it that was terrible with, like, boobs in it?
Yes.
Well,
and you avoid that.
They did. There was Boggy Creek 2, which I can't even remember what it was called, and it came out about 2 years later, if I'm not mistaken. And then there was a movie directed again by Pierce in the 80s, I think 83, called Boggy Creek 2, The Legend Continues, and that's the true sequel to Legend of Boggy Creek, but it's pretty bad. For whatever reason, Pierce just kind of moved away from doing the pseudo-documentary style, and he went more for like this classic kind of horror style, and it doesn't work at all. Random trivia, though, a piece of trivia. There's a scene at the beginning of that movie that's great, where this poor defenseless deer is crossing a river, and all of a sudden it gets pulled underwater, and you see its head float to the surface, and there's blood everywhere. The lady whose pet deer that was, we stayed at like her hotel when we were in Falk to make our movie. She actually contacted me about the fact that she had owned that deer, and we ended up staying at her hotel. But that was the most random little. She was actually the lady that owned the deer that was killed in Boggy Creek 2.
How bizarre!
Yeah.
Oh, God.
So in the documentaries, I hear a few people say it reminds them of a Neanderthal. I'm just kind of curious, from talking to all these people and your own perceptions, what do you think Bigfoot is? And I kind of lean towards the paranormal stuff, and I've had weird, crazy Bigfoot people try to stalk me and threaten to beat me up just because I think Bigfoot's paranormal. Like, there are some that are that are crazy, and they get mad.
Yeah.
Like, they get violent.
Yeah, there's camps. That's the hilarious thing about the Bigfoot quote-unquote community, is they eat their own.
Yeah. It's like they're going to get mad at me and call me a kook and tinfoil hatter, but they're out in the woods chasing down a giant King Kong. You know, it's like, don't you see something here? The irony here. But what do you think from talking to them and your perception?
See, my belief is that it's an ape, an undiscovered ape, and that comes from more than just working on these movies. I've been doing this for about 12 years, and part of my involvement in it came from exploring kind of newspaper archives and historical records, and I found numerous newspaper articles, especially from here in Ohio, that referred to them as ape and ape-like, and I think typically, and again, I'm more on the skeptical side. In fact, I find myself more skeptical every year, it seems like, but I still am fascinated by the witness stories, and I don't have an easy explanation for this thing. I always say there's no easy pat answer for whether or not Bigfoot exists. For me, you know, there's too many people that honestly believe they've seen something that I've spoken to for me to just shoot everyone down as like a hoaxer, or they're just misidentifying a bear or something. But I, from what I've looked into, I see the evidence pointing toward some sort of ape, and that comes from, you know, footprint evidence and kind of the witness descriptions. You do get a lot of those Neanderthal descriptions. I even believe that Brian said that the face reminded him more of what you think of as a Neanderthal, although he did say the body was very ape-like. I don't know if you've seen our Beast of Whitehall poster, I would imagine.
Yeah.
But
That poster, he said that is extremely close to what he saw. So if you see the Beast of Whitehall poster, that's pretty much what he saw that night in the field. So it's very ape-like. So that's kind of where I lean, is I'm more on the ape side of things, although I'm not going to threaten to kill you because you don't think so.
That's good. Yeah. Well, my thing is I've interviewed Stan Gordon, and he has all these cases in Pennsylvania of Bigfoot and UFOs like happening at the same time. So I'm wondering if there's some interstellar Wookiee kind of stuff going on or something.
Yeah. No, I know Stan. I was at an event with Stan like last weekend. So
great. He's one of my favorites for sure. Yep. I love Stan. Definitely has some wild cases that are very bizarre.
Yeah, I mean, there's no these cases, and it seems like a lot of these cases that we investigate do have the kind of weirder slant to them. Minerva had it, although not as prevalent as Whitehall. Whitehall is the first time where I was investigating a case that I thought was a very clear-cut Bigfoot case, and then came to find out there's all this other stuff that goes on in that area. Now, with a Falk monster, you know, the Boggy Creek case, that one, there didn't seem to be any other super unusual activity that was taking place around that same time. You know, there were no UFO reports that I heard of, or any of that kind of thing. So at least that one, I finally got to investigate a story that seems like a pretty upfront Bigfoot sighting. Although, you know, we do have talk of mountain lions kind of roaming around, at least in the same vicinity as these things down there. So maybe there's a tie-in with Minerva. Who knows?
I've heard of white Bigfoots in South America with, like, panthers, too, from somewhere. I think with Andy, we've talked about that before, Andrew Colvin. I've heard something about that somewhere, white Bigfoots and panthers in South America. I can't remember. I think it was some stories with Andy or... maybe it was already Six Killer Clark. I can't remember, but someone, we've talked about that before, for sure. And you had mentioned earlier, what was the ones that were people had been, the location where people had been seeing Bigfoot with panthers and stuff?
Well, that was the Minerva case.
Minerva case, okay.
Yeah, but, and then down in Falk, it wasn't that people were seeing them together, but they were... There was a lot of conjecture as to what was going on down at Falk. There was obviously like we talked about early on, when these cases first start breaking, typically the response is ridicule. And if you read the newspaper articles that were coming out around that same time, most of them were just making fun of the people. In fact, they insisted, one of the newspapers and a lot of the people that lived in the area insisted that what the Ford family saw, and if you've seen the movie, the Legend of Boggy Creek kind of culminates in this sighting at the Ford house with a guy on the toilet and a creature
right.
Sticks his hand through the window. And that's,
yeah, that's the one that scared me, yeah.
Yeah, that's all based on a true story, and that man really did go to the hospital, really did suffer from shock. Something, you know, did attack that family that night. But it's up in the air as to what it was. The newspaper was insistent that it was a horse, that the family had seen a horse that typically roamed around loose through the area. And then some people were saying that it was a mountain lion. And then the family was insistent that it was an upright walking, you know, hair-covered creature. I can tell you from being down in that area that when you're out in some of those rural places around Falk and in southwestern Arkansas in general, everything wants to kill you. Like,
absolutely.
Every stop we would get out of the car and someone would be like, you know, make sure you watch out for this. And it got to the point where there was a stop we made on our last day where we got out of the car and someone said, now, you know, I was going to have to remain back at the car with about three of my other guys. We were just going to shoot some B-roll, but it was after dark. And they said they were going down, this other team were going down to shoot on the lake. And they said before they left, they said, now watch out for the roaming packs of feral pit bulls. And I mm-hmm. thought they were joking, and they were not joking. There are legitimately, we saw them later that night, feral pit bulls just roaming around the hills In this particular area, and they will mess you up. So
I'm sure they will. Oh my god!
And there's also hogs and rattlesnakes and copperheads, and we saw a cottonmouth snake in the middle of the road. And I mean, it seems like everywhere you go, something wants to murder you down there.
Nice. That incident in Lake County is hard to find because I was just searching for it a little bit, and I know I have it somewhere, but God knows where kind of situation. So I was just seeing if there's a backup route to seeing it, and you can't find it anywhere. I mean anywhere. Mm. It used to be on VHS, and it's not even that was on Amazon. But definitely like to watch that again and see Boggy Creek again. I don't know why I keep calling it Boggy. Because I'm from Georgia, that's what we say, Boggy Creek.
Yeah, but, I've heard that a lot, actually.
Boggy?
Boggy, yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's how my dad referred to it.
Boggy?
Yeah.
So, I'm glad you put the extra features. I mean, what do you think about the length? I know your sound guy was talking about he wanted to make it longer, the movie longer or something. Because I saw 40 minutes, I was like, that's kind of short, but thank God there's all these features. That was like, what, about 2 hours worth of stuff, like 70 and 40?
Yeah, so Minerva's a 55-minute movie. It was originally supposed to be a 20-minute YouTube short. None of us had ever made a movie when we did Minerva, and it was supposed to be a 20-minute movie. We were going to post it on a YouTube channel that the producers already had. And then when we landed a couple of our big interviews, we realized we needed to go further with it, and then we put it on DVD, and then we ended up showing it all over the state and that kind of stuff. But with Whitehall was conceived as a 15-minute Kickstarter reward. It was going to be solely available as a digital download for people that backed the Boggy Creek Monster. Boggy Creek Monster was going to be our first full-scale feature-length movie. So, what happened is, with Whitehall, once we got into editing, even though, if you watch the movie, there are only 7 main interviews in the entire movie. That doesn't include the audio tapes, which ends up filling in about 5 minutes of the movie. But we were concerned that we wouldn't have enough story, and then when we got into editing, we realized we have plenty of story, and there's ways to do this that make, you know, that keep the pace moving. But beyond 40 minutes, we didn't have enough, and part of the reason is so many of the witnesses have passed away. I mean, short of basically just doing some sort of narration constant where you would have got, you know, another 20 minutes of narration, there was no way to do it. And to just, I think for 40 minutes was a good length. What Brandon wanted most was is what ended up in the movie. We really wanted to pump up the talk a little bit more about the teenagers, the kids that were in that initial truck. And those kids, the one is dead, Paul Gosselin's dead, and the other two kids don't want anything to do with the case. So it was hard to figure out a way to do that, but we ended up coming up with a way to at least make them a little more, you know, in the forefront. But I agree with you. Like, for us, if I could do 2-hour movies on every one of these stories, I would. Because it's so fascinating. Each story is so unique and kind of there's so many avenues to explore. But with Whitehall, we did with the material, we were able to do what we could with it, and I was extremely glad that we could actually put it out on DVD because we never thought that would be the case. We thought it would be a little short film, you know, that would be a Kickstarter reward, and then someday we might include it on, you know, like the Boggy Creek DVD or something like that. So to have it be its own thing was kind of special for us. And then, you know, like you said, it's important to me that we load the DVDs with stuff. I thought unedited interviews would be kind of a cool, kind of extended interviews would be cool for some people because they get to play detective and actually go through those and pick out all the details that aren't in the movie. And then the making of behind the scenes stuff is always, I love behind the scenes features on DVDs. That's always been one of my favorite things to watch. And so, especially on Boggy, we actually took a guy with us as part of the crew, and his sole job was to document kind of the behind-the-scenes stuff. So behind-the-scenes on Boggy Creek is going to be pretty amazing, I think, because we have hours and hours of footage.
Nice.
So, yeah, we really documented a lot of that stuff. And the coolest thing is Boggy was so chaotic and so crazy. I mean, our first day there, we were roaring around the swamps being driven in these boats by guys that were just drunk off the rear ends from Jägermeister. And one of our guys is filming it all. And I'm like, I cannot wait to have this on behind the scenes. Cause like, we're just, you know, total newbies to the swamps. And these guys are, you know, just flying around, you know, trees, and there's snakes and alligators coming out of the water and all kind of craziness. So the behind the scenes on that is going to be fantastic.
Nice. Are there any Dogman famous cases that are real? There's Linda Godfrey's done some stuff on that. Where's that at? The Dogman.
Bray Road. Bray Road.
Yeah, Bray Road. Because Dogman needs some love.
Well, I got to tell you, there's Dogman sightings maybe 10 minutes from my house. I live about 10 minutes from Silver Creek Metro Park, and if you look online, Silver Creek Dogman, there's a bunch of sightings. In fact, Linda was just here, I think, a couple years ago or last year to investigate these sightings, and they're not 10 minutes from my house. In fact, my wife and I go hiking over there pretty often. It's something I would definitely explore. We've talked about doing Bray Road, but you know, Linda's covered that so intensely, and then it's also been covered in a lot of other media, and that's one of the things we're trying to avoid, is kind of just going after stories that have already been done ad nauseum on every cryptid or, you know, paranormal show out there. We kind of like to find stories that haven't been, you know, documented nonstop. With Minerva, no one had ever done it, really, other than Ripley's, believe it or not, back in the 80s, there was a TV show. They had done something on it, and the show had been mentioned on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries. But, and Whitehall had been covered, but it had never been covered in the way we did, which is to actually let the witnesses tell their stories. And then with the Boggy Creek case, while it was covered, we felt like there's a whole history to Falk, Arkansas that's never been explored. Beyond that original movie, and we wanted to do something that would explore not just, you know, the legend of Boggy Creek and its impact on the community, but also what the history of unusual creature sightings in Falk is, you know, not just back then, but all the way up till today, and how it's impacted the community. So Bray Road would definitely be something fun to approach, but for one thing, we have to involve Linda because she's kind of the expert there. And then the other is you've got to find angles to it and witnesses that haven't already been on every one of these shows.
Yeah, are you familiar with Monteagle, Tennessee, and that story at all? Because I got a buddy that lives there, and he just showed me a picture of one of those, you know, signs that there's been a Bigfoot sighting right when you come into the town and stuff. Are you familiar with that at all, Monteagle, Tennessee?
No, I am familiar with a Tennessee small town monster kind of case, but it's not Monteagle.
Which one is that?
I'm not even sure right now. I'm trying to think of what the name of the town is. I'll have to ask my buddy.
Cool. Well, let me see.
Well, there's always the Kinderhook creature.
Yeah.
I'm sure you've heard about it, but there's not been a full documentary, I don't think, done on it. And what work that I've done since it's close, and I actually know the guy whose grandmother was the first person to actually be a witness of this creature.
Oh wow!
There's a lot more to the story. I mean, the only thing that was really done about the story occurred briefly. When it was happening in the mid 80s, there was like a brief mention, like a 10 minute segment on, you know, one of those weekly night shows, news
mm-hmm.
shows, but
yeah.
There hasn't been like a full, you know, film documentary of it. And it is an interesting case because it's connected. Not only did a lot of people see whatever this was, but including policemen who had some interesting encounters. But it was it was part of a larger community thing that happened, and there were other things that happened as well. So it was it happened, like, I can't remember if it was right before or right after the massive UFO flap that occurred in the Hudson Valley in the mid-80s.
Yeah.
Can't remember if it was right before or right after that. So there was a little bit of overlap of some of that, you know, in the, at least in the reporting of some people. So it's actually, I mean, when I first heard about it, I thought, oh, this was just another one of these, you know, Hudson Valley weird things. And then I talked to Bruce, who's this guy I mentioned, and there's actually a lot more to it than I thought even.
What's
so,
Bruce?
Bruce Hallenbeck.
It's Bruce Hallenbeck. His mother's in Beast of Whitehall, then.
Is she?
Yeah, she's featured. She's one of the people that are in the. There's a news clip that opens the last chapter of the movie.
That's interesting. I don't know. I believe
that's his mother. It's either his mother or it's a relative of his. I think it might Paul be a, told
it might,
me.
It might be a relative of his. I don't know. But his grandmother was in Kinderhook, was the first person to report seeing this creature. And it's a really interesting account because it's very unusual. It was towards evening, I believe, and she was in the kitchen making some tea. And she just happened to look outside, you know, the kitchen window. And she noticed this big lump thing curled up like it was sleeping in her yard. Mm-hmm. And she thought it was a big dog. Like, because it would look like a big dog curled up, sleeping in her yard, except it was massive. And she thought that was odd. She just sort of looked at it and was like, what, you know, what is that? And then I believe, if I remember the story right, there was like some other kind of loud noise or something, or maybe people, or like a car or something was coming up the road. And all of a sudden, what she thought was this large dog suddenly stood upright, and it was like 8 foot tall, and just, you know, walked all the way across the lawn into the forest, you know, to get away from whatever the noise was.
Right.
And of course scared the crap out of her because she thought it was a big, large dog, even though she thought it was odd. And then it just did this thing, you know, it just did this very unusual thing. But that was like the opening gambit of a series of experiences that the community started to have.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
They're rather unusual stories in some ways. I found that they were not typical Bigfoot stories. But
okay.
That might be something you might want to look at some point.
Definitely. And I love that region.
Wham hasn't seen the documentaries yet. She doesn't have a TV. She's Amish.
I'm not Amish. I'm obviously on Skype.
You don't watch TV though.
I don't have a TV. But you know, the DVDs are available for purchase, I'm assuming.
Yes.
For me, I'm glued to a giant 60.
Yes, I know. I mean, your face could be its own screen, Jeffrey. I mean, I know.
My whole life is a screen. It's quite pathetic.
I mean, between you and your video games, geez, you know.
I know. Doom, baby, it's waiting. That's right. I'm excited.
Well, I apologize for not having seen the documentaries before the interview, but I teach and I have been in the middle of grading finals and things. So.
I would not hold it against you at all.
How would
so.
You, though? You don't have a TV.
But I do want to see the thing about Whitehall because Whitehall is extremely important to me. You know.
How are you going to watch it?
Huh?
Can you watch it online? Like a...
It's streaming through Vimeo, too.
Oh, okay.
It's streaming through Vimeo. Okay, that's fine.
Either way.
But now that you've talked about the Minerva monster, I'm interested in seeing that as well.
They're both really good. Like, I mean, it's hard to find good documentaries about this stuff. They're good.
It's hard to find it, and it's hard to find it where it's not on, you know, some major network where it's slanted in their favor one way or the other. So
right.
we try to keep ourselves out of the movie. Obviously, we're not in it. I'm not in the movies. It's about our witnesses, and then sometimes, you know, if there's a major investigator.
I hope you don't ever plan to do, like, weird finding Bigfoot green when you're in the woods, night vision, crazy.
Right. Yeah. No, we do our best to stay as far away from that as we can.
Good. That stuff makes me, like, nauseous. Like, I liked all the, where they interview people and stuff on finding Bigfoot and, like, in the town meetings and stuff, but that stuff when they're out in the woods, it makes me want to throw up.
Yeah, that's the way with a lot of people. I mean, that, you know, our approach is to let the witnesses tell their stories, let the stories be as dramatic as they actually are, because there's something inherently terrifying about a lot of these cases, without us trying to pump it up, you know, with a guy in a suit or something. That's kind of our approach.
And the art and the music make it, too. I mean, that's a big part of it that I enjoy, too.
Definitely. The Matt Harris has done kind of the illustrations for both movies, and then Maz Adams did some of the sketches that are in Beast of Whitehall, and those are fantastic. And then Brandon Dalo, who's the producer as well, he does all our music, which is pretty amazing. You know, for an independent film company, typically an indie film, you've got to just buy music. Like, we would typically be purchasing music off of MusicBed or something and just generically sticking it in the movie. And Brandon came along during the post-production process on Minerva Monster and just wanted to do music for us. And, you know, at first I was very skeptical of it, because you get I've probably had more offers for music than anything else. But his scores have been fantastic, especially on Whitehall. He upped the game so much over what he did on Minerva.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing them. I mean, this is going to give me something to do this weekend. So yay. No, I agree with Jeffrey. I mean, my interest has been more in UFOs and hauntings, and even with all of the stuff that's been done, obviously, with those kinds of experiences too. In both cases, the number of really good documentaries that exist, you can still list on one hand. You know, there is so much garbage out there on both, you know, about both these topics, that it's an embarrassment. Really.
No, I agree. I agree totally. I encourage other filmmakers. That's why we're doing Minerva Monster Day. It's we're inviting other kind of independent filmmakers that are tackling these subjects to show their movies. And that was something I wanted to do pretty much from day one of working on Minerva, because there isn't a huge audience. You see a lot of people making their own little documentaries about Bigfoot or paranormal stuff and then putting them on YouTube. And that was how I found one of our movies we're showing is called Mystery at Loch Ness. And we're going to show that at Minerva Monster Day. And I just found that on YouTube. I mean, the director had just kind of made the movie. And these are passion projects. You put your heart and soul and your own money into making them. And then you put them on YouTube or whatever. You know, in our case, we're able to sell them. But, I mean, pretty much what we do with Small Town Monsters is we sell the movies, and then we just use that to fund the next movie. I mean, that's pretty much how we've been functioning. And I am able to do this pretty much full-time just to work on these. So that's been great. But, you know, it's all about love of the subject and having some sort of vision for something that I don't think people are getting right now, which is kind of our approach to it, which is to take it very seriously, but at the same time, don't try to push our audience in one direction or another. Let them make up their own mind.
Right. And I think that, you know, especially in the area of UFO stuff, that approach could really illuminate what is true about these experiences, which is that regardless of what is going on, people are being dramatically changed by these experiences.
Right.
And you know, that's why I got started in the research that I did for 40 years in looking at UFOs, because I found even today I'm not entirely sure exactly what's going on. In fact, I'm not sure that it's always the same thing that's going on in each given case or in each given flap or group of people or individual having an experience. But I can't really deny sometimes that something's happening to some of these people, or that they're having these experiences, because there's it certainly is pointing out that there's much about life that we really don't know very much about.
Right.
So
I have a mean question from someone. I'm going to read it.
Oh, good.
Deep question.
I battled. It's like, I don't really feel like, you know, the guy's bugging me on Facebook, Dan Miller, so I'm going to ask one of his questions, and it's Dan Miller's thoughts and perceptions, not the show's, not mine. So, when Mr. Breedlove was interviewed by Dave Schrader of Darkness Radio earlier this year, Breedlove stated that he preferred not to be considered a Bigfoot investigator, nor does he have any interest in investigating the existence of this creature, and overall not convinced that this creature exists. With that said, where does his motivation come from to do these documentaries, and why should anyone believe Breedlove has any genuine sincerity towards this subject matter? Seems to me Bigfoot is simply an entertainment opportunity for Breedlove.
That's a good one, though. I actually just had a guy the other day tell me that the only reason I'm in it is for fame and fortune, which, I mean, as people that investigate this stuff, or I'm not, like he said, I'm not an investigator. I'm a filmmaker and a podcaster. That's what I do. I investigate the stories, but I don't, you know, investigate the reality of the creature. But the fame and fortune thing is hysterical. If you have any idea how independent film works.
I do.
There's just no fame and fortune really to be made here unless I'm on Animal Planet, which is obviously not happening. So
they want to pay your own way anyway. The ones that ask me, they're like, you got to pay. I'm like, well, I'm not going.
Right, unless you have your own show. I'm not even, even as a personality on those shows. But no, for me, it's always been, I'm fascinated by the subject. That's why I talk about it on the radio every week. That's why I make movies about it. I'm totally fascinated in the subject, but also, you know, I don't have to believe, and I also don't have to prove to anyone that I have some legitimate interest in it. That would be like me asking, I'm super into comic books. That would be like me trying to make someone else that's into comic books prove to me that they're into comic books. It's just idiotic to expect someone to do that. And that's, see, this is like a weird week to ask me that question, because my fuse has already been lit on this one. So like, yeah, so for me, like when people come do stuff like that, it just comes across as hysterically arrogant to act like somehow you're like I'm the Bigfoot guy. You have to prove to me that you have, you know, some legitimate interest in it. I really don't. I don't have to prove to anyone that I have an interest in it. I love the subject. I've had it. I've been into it for 12 years. I make movies about it because, like I said, part of it is that I love the history. And there's more to this than just people seeing a Bigfoot and a town being affected. There's lives that are impacted by it, and those people love having the opportunity to tell their story in a way where I'm not making fun of them, and we're not making fun of them, or even worse, we're not making them the butt of some sort of like paranormal horror show. I don't know if you guys know what I'm talking about, but there's a lot of shows, where they turn it into basically just an excuse to have, you know, people running through the woods and screaming. So no, my interest in this is pretty much because I love making movies and I love telling stories and I love people. I'm more interested in the human side of this phenomenon than I am in the supernatural or paranormal side of it. I'm fascinated by the people. And I like people. That's what got me into newspaper reporting. And it's carried over into filmmaking. But as far as like me having any kind of desire to prove to someone like Dan my interest in it, I don't have an interest in proving to anyone what you know, that I have like a legitimate interest in that.
you seem sincere to me, and I love your documentary. That's what I told him. I was like, I don't have a problem with Seth. I'm not looking really for drama, but I'll ask one of your questions.
No, ask. Yeah, and that's the other thing. Like, don't feel bad about it, and Dan shouldn't feel bad about it for asking, because, you know, we're all in the same kind of boat. I mean, we're all interested in this thing, and there's something about it that draws us all to it, I think, right? I mean, we all have some sort of legitimate interest in it. The idea, though, that people like us are out there solely for fame and fortune is funny if you're in our position, which is not, you know, something where we're making boatloads of money.
I say only I could be semi-famous or whatever and still be poor at the same time. Only I can manage that one. pick the subject that leads you to the poorhouse. You know?
Right.
That's the way the paranormal field is, you know. It's like...
Leave it up to me to pick that one. Well, I didn't really... It picked me more like it, because I had weird stuff happen to me, and that's what kind of drug me into it. Yeah. But, we've really enjoyed you on the show, and I hope to get you back each documentary if possible. Definitely enjoyed it. Where's the best place, Seth, for everybody to pick up the DVD?
Shop.smalltownmonsters.com, and they stream on Vimeo at vimeo.com/smalltownmonsters, and we're also working on getting them on Amazon. They should be on Amazon streaming hopefully later this summer. And then we're working on some other distribution platforms right now, but we're also trying to get Boggy Creek done. So that's kind of taken on these movies. It's really only Brandon and I at this point that are working on them. So we kind of cover everything, and that includes like packing and shipping orders and all that kind of stuff. So it's an endless work job for us.
Definitely. And to me, I mean, this subject's alienated me a lot from society on many levels, just being involved in it on any level. It alienates you on, quite literally. But we've enjoyed you. Thanks for doing the show, and keep us in the loop on the next one. And thanks a lot, man. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, guys.
And I hope to see you in September.
Yeah, I would love to talk to you more about that, the Native American stuff. That is fascinating.
Oh, yeah, I've got a lot of info.
All right.
Enjoy your destiny, and I have to go into Doom and kill Martian Hell Demon.
Yes, and the cat just came in, and I realized she's gotten skunked, so I've got to go do some cleaning.
Good night, everybody. Take care.
See
bye-bye.
See you later. Bye-bye.
Take care.
If you were listening to the show and wish to join us in the chat room, visit pal